We live in a world of dissatisfaction on all levels, individual all the way up to national. Seems that as human beings, we're prone to that. In fact, we kind of seem to be prone to that from birth, don't we? Dissatisfaction. I've been amused at our latest grandson at how quickly he learned the word mine. See something that you want? If you get your hands on it, you yell the word mine, it gets to stay in your hand. I mean, that's the way it normally works. Like the remote, if the parents happen to leave it too close to him, then all of a sudden it's mine. But that satisfaction dissipates pretty quickly when he realizes that, hey, I'm supposed to be able to push buttons and Thomas the Train will come on the TV and he starts mashing buttons and nothing happens and suddenly he's dissatisfied again, isn't he? Okay, get out of the grandparent mode, but it seems we begin pretty early with the dissatisfaction, don't we? In fact, that's what Satan got to Eve with in getting her to eat from the wrong tree, the forbidden fruit. Dissatisfaction on a national level, we've seen it in the greater scheme of things. Many nations have a huge level of unrest in their populace. And over the last several years, we have seen that lead to the overthrow of governments. Actual national governments being overthrown. And dissatisfaction in marriage is becoming more obvious in our nation as well. It's been commonly reported that about half of marriages end in divorce. You can find that general statement disputed at times, but the recent fact is that the raw number of divorces in our country is going up again. 2009, it hit kind of a low point. But since 2009, for the last 3 years, it has steadily increased every year. And it went up again last year as well. 2.4 million divorces were filed in 2012, I guess is the last year that I have the statistics for. Marriage and family have been on my mind lately with our national holiday of Mother's Day. And several articles I've found or have been sent in the last couple of weeks have been on that topic as well. So we talked about a few aspects of family in the Bible study last Sabbath, but since I haven't given a sermon on it in a while, I thought I would explore this topic of marriage, the marriage relationship today in the sermon. I want to start with a saying in the book of Proverbs. Now, the book of Proverbs is a collection of sayings by Solomon. Not only sayings that he personally said, but also sayings that he read or that he collected from others and thought, this is good stuff. This is something to put in my book as well. So it's not all authored by him, but he's a man of great wisdom. In fact, God said back in 1 Kings there was not going to be anyone like him before or after him. And Solomon is this wise individual, a man of a very wise heart who searched out all of these sayings. And if he, a wisest man, of course, accepting God in the flesh, says they're important, seems we ought to pay a little bit of attention to them at least. The Zondervan NIV Study Bible points out that the purpose of the book, the whole book of Proverbs, and I'm not going to turn to the start of the book, but if you read the first few verses, actually the first seven verses, the whole purpose of the book is to give prudence to the simple, knowledge and discretion to the young, and to make wise men even wiser. So if you're already wise, it pays to listen nonetheless. If you're not already a wise person, then it is a very good thing to listen to what the book of Proverbs has to say, because you can become wise from following these instructions. I'd like to turn to Proverbs chapter 30. Take a look at something that is stated here. In Proverbs chapter 30, we note from verse 1, this is the next to the last chapter in the book, we note from verse 1 that this is a collection of sayings from somebody else. This chapter is not written by Solomon himself. In fact, verse 1 says, the words of Agur, the son of Jacob, his utterance, this man declared to Ithiel and Ukal. And it then begins giving some of the instructions that this individual said. Now, the Midrash tries to ascribe this to Solomon. Seems like they go through some etymological hoops to try to ascribe this to Solomon in a very far stretch, but I think most scholars agree that these were not the words of Solomon. These were words that Solomon searched out, and these were words that were spoken by somebody else. But Solomon evaluated them, and he said, these are good things. These are wise sayings. And so he included it in his book. Now, what I want to read is actually verse 19. And in particular, there's only one clause out of verse 19 that I want to read, or that I want to focus on. But it doesn't make much sense unless we start in verse 18. So let's go to Proverbs 30, and we'll start in verse 18. Proverbs 30 and verse 18 says, there are three things which are too wonderful for me. Yes, four which I do not understand. Now, you got to realize this is a wise person speaking. This is someone of great wisdom, someone that Solomon looked at, read his information, and said, yes, this is valuable stuff. I'm going to put it in my book of Proverbs. And he's saying, these are things that are too wonderful for me. I can't even understand this stuff. Four of them. I don't really get it. Verse 19, the way of an eagle in the air. Of course, today, with our modern science and stop-motion photography and all kinds of things, we gather a little bit more understanding about how eagles fly in the air. The way of a serpent on a rock. Same thing. Scientific discovery has helped us understand how serpents can move even on a slippery surface. The way of a ship in the midst of the sea. And that we can understand a bit more when we understand currents and we understand wind and we understand more of, again, science. And then we get to that last one, the way of a man with a virgin. Or as other translations say, today's English version translates that as a man and a woman falling in love. I don't understand that, he says. How is it that that happens? What is it that gets triggered in the hearts of people, in the minds, in the seat of the emotions that causes that spark? Now, sometimes it's a fleeting spark. Sometimes it's a spark, and there's an interest, and then it kind of dies out quickly. Well, it was an interest, but it wasn't really a lasting interest. And other times it gets fanned into a flame that lasts for a lifetime of love between two people. How is it that that happens? What causes that? What causes people to be attracted to one another? You know, we look at people who have married and who are happily married, and sometimes you look at the temperaments and you say, well, these people are pretty similar in their temperaments, and you know, they kind of mesh with one another, and seems like, yeah, that'd be a good match. And then you look at other couples where, I mean, on just about every scale you can think of, they're opposites. And yet they seem to be a good match for some reason. They've made it work. What is it about a man and a maiden that brings them together and can cause them to have a life of happiness together, to make a go of a marriage? And of course, there are many, many in between those extremes. So it's not just personality. It's not just interest, although I do believe anyone considering marriage ought to get a lot of counsel early in the process to look at, okay, here's what this person is like today, very different from me. Can we make this work? What are the potential easy things that are going to be easy for us to mesh in? And what are the potential things down the road where we're not quite on the same plane, we're not quite on the same page of the book, maybe we're not even in the same book, maybe we're in different books, but what is this going to look like 20, 30, 40 years from now? What are the potential difficulties we might face if I let my heart go, if I become fully engaged in this relationship? I think it's wise to get that kind of counsel. Just try to kind of wrap our mind around the potentials, the strengths, and also some of the things we might face later on. Now, my purpose is not to talk about premarriage counseling issues today, but I wanted to read this passage to point out that there are reasons people feel you cannot understand the opposite sex. I mean, who understands this stuff? Who understands how this really works? And I will say, wiser men than me, wiser men than I, is that the correct grammar? Yes. Wiser men than I have said, you can't understand it. You know, there are parts of this that are beyond human comprehension. So let's kind of put that out there. They think differently. The opposite sex, no matter which side you're looking from, the opposite sex thinks differently. They feel things differently. They process things differently. They have a different, often, perspective on things than you might have. And once two people who think and feel and experience life a little differently begin their life as a married couple, it's very common in our society for dissatisfaction to crop up when they realize some differences that they didn't know existed when they began their life together. What I want to do today, though, is look at something that I've felt for many years, in fact, a couple of decades, is a crucial aspect of understanding the opposite sex, because I think we can have a certain level of understanding of the opposite sex, a certain level of what's needed. Shocking as it may sound, in many ways, men and women are similar, but not the same. But we're similar. I mean, we are rather similar. Notice Paul's perspective at the Areopagus on Mars Hill in Athens in Acts chapter 17. Take a look at what Paul says here to the people of Athens. Now, he's talking about all of the idols that he saw, and he says, you are worshiping even this unknown God. Well, let me tell you about this unknown God then, the one you worship in ignorance. This is the one I'm going to proclaim to you. We'll pick it up in verse 24, Acts chapter 17 and verse 24. It says, God, who made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. And in Athens, there were lots and lots and lots of temples. Nor is he worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life, breath, and all things. And there were many, many, many idols in the city of Athens. And people would worship, thinking they were worshiping God by worshiping these idols. He said he doesn't need all of that. But verse 26 is the one I wanted to focus on. He says, and he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and boundaries and their dwellings, so that they might seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope for him and find him, though he's not far from each one of us. Now, the word men has made for one blood every nation of men. The Greek word for men is anthropos. Thayer's Greek lexicon says that particular word has to do with humanity. It's the genus of human beings as compared to animals. And it very specifically says that it has nothing to do with sex. Thayer says, without distinction of sex, it is a human being, whether male or female. In this sense, Paul is using this, we are all the same in God's eyes. We're all made of one blood. Human beings are one type. We are universal. And you might say, well, the context says, in seeking God. Okay, I can accept that. We're all one in seeking God. We're all the same in that. Every one of us needs God. We all need that relationship with Him. We're universal in our need for God. Galatians 3 gives a somewhat similar statement. Galatians 3, verses 27 to 29. Here Paul says in verse 27, for as many of you as were baptized into Christ have put on Christ. There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. And if you're Christ, then you're Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promised. So we all stand before God identically, male or female. And since we have the same responsibility, we have the same duties, to love and obey God, to be devoted, to be faithful to Him, to be faithful to Him alone. And not only do we have the same need for God, but if you think about it, we're really universal in many basic needs, food, shelter, clothing. We all have need of that, male or female, no distinction there. We're also universal in a number of emotional and psychological ways. Yes, we need the connection with God, but we all have a certain level of need of connections with other human beings. That is something built into our human psyche, male or female. We all have that desire to be special and to hold and to be held dear by another person. We're very, very much alike in that way, male or female. So we have a lot of similarities, but we're not the same, are we? We do have distinctions. We do have differences. Science has proven that. And the Bible recognizes that as well. And it makes allowance for that difference in our psychological makeup. I mentioned in the Congregational Bible Study this last Sabbath that God gave females, in general, more of that aspect of His personality, more of that aspect of His psyche, when He talked about, even though a woman would forget her child, I'm not going to forget those of you who are special to me. It's a God attribute to be attached to those that are special to you. God gave more of that to women, gave more of other things to men. Again, in general. I'd like to take note of Peter's comments about our differences as well in 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3. Now, for us old-timers who've been around the church for many years, we probably immediately think of two words when we think of 1 Peter chapter 3 and we talk about marriage, don't we? We typically think of two words. I want you to not jump to the conclusion of two words at this point. Let's take a little bit of time to look at this passage. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 1 says, "Wives, likewise be submissive to your own husbands, that," so there's a reason he makes this statement, "that for the purpose of, even if some do not obey the word, they without a word may be won by the conduct of their wives." There's a very distinct purpose for what Peter is saying. Now, he does say submit. There is this aspect of submission. Why does he say this? And it's not that all women submit to all men. You nowhere find that in the Bible. Some seem to take that perspective. But we've already established we're all one before God. We are all the same. We're of the same blood. We're the same in our need for a relationship with God. We're on a level playing field in terms of salvation, if you want to put it that way. And yet God has ordained a certain amount of structure to society, to His church, to society as a whole, and to the family, that God has ascribed a certain level of responsibility. He's designated husbands to have certain duties and responsibilities within the family unit. Husbands to be the leader. Now, before we go further with this, I would like to move to verse 7. Verse 7, Peter turns his emphasis to husbands. Verse 7, 1 Peter 3 says, "Husbands, likewise, dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered." While Peter says there is a difference, he says you're on a level playing field in terms of your salvation. You are heirs together. So he's back to talking about our sameness, isn't he, as male and female. The emphasis is for husbands to lead, but to do that with understanding. To lead in a way that shows, I understand we're on an even playing field in terms of our relationship to God, in terms of our salvation. I understand there are a lot of similarities between us, male and female. But I also understand there are some differences. I recognize that. Men are reminded that they need to honor their wife. It's very easy for us to begin to dishonor people, or to take people for granted, or to take one another for granted in a marriage relationship. But husbands are reminded, you need to give honor to your wife. Yes, recognize she's generally, again, speaking in generalities, generally she's a little bit weaker physically, doesn't quite have the muscular structure that the man does in most cases, but give her honor because she's on equal footing. You're on equal footing before God in terms of salvation, and you don't want your prayers hindered. So don't do things that will hinder your prayers. Honor her. Lead, but do it with understanding. I want to mention another grammatical point that might not have jumped out to you immediately. Have you ever noticed that word likewise? The word likewise really struck me this week when I was looking at this. Likewise. What do you mean likewise? Wives, verse 1, likewise. Husbands, verse 7, likewise. Likewise what? What do you mean likewise? But we're not the same. Well, we're similar. But not exactly the same. What's the context of this? Likewise what? We're supposed to do something, but likewise what? What's the context? Well, the immediate context, if you back up from chapter 3, you see the end of chapter 2. Now, what's the immediate context of the end of chapter 2? Well, the immediate context is that Jesus Christ, while he was, in one sense, on a level playing field with human beings because he was living in the flesh, he was still superior in the sense of being God. He was God in the flesh. And as God in the flesh, he never sinned. He didn't deserve to die. He didn't deserve to suffer. And yet he put our needs, the needs of us human beings who are similar to him, not exactly the same, but similar to what he was like in the flesh, he put our needs above his desire to continue to live and to avoid suffering. You remember his prayer to the Father the night he was betrayed? He prayed so fervently, apparently the capillaries in his forehead began to burst. It looked like he was sweating blood, drops of blood falling from it. That's intense. I don't know if you've ever prayed that hard. I haven't. But that has to be intense. He knew what he was facing. And he said, if there's any way to avoid this, please avoid it. Nevertheless, not what I want, but what's best for the greater good. He put our needs above his desires. That impresses me to think about likewise. Likewise, wives. Likewise, husbands. As Jesus Christ placed the needs of others above his own desires, you fulfill these responsibilities I've given you in the flesh. So you think about this context. How did he get to talking about Jesus Christ suffering unlawfully or improperly, where he didn't really need to suffer, didn't deserve it, undeservedly? How did he get to that point? Well, you really have to back up a ways to find where that particular passage begins. In fact, you almost go all the way back to verse 9. You are a chosen generation, verse 9 says, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light. Because we are chosen by God now to have this opportunity for salvation. Because of that special calling, we have a calling to do something that's different than perhaps the rest of humanity at this point. That's really the beginning point of this. Because we are to become like Jesus Christ, we need to consider the good of others and sometimes put that ahead of ourselves. Expositor's Bible commentary on this verse, chapter 3, verse 1, where it talks about wives being submissive, it says the likewise of verses 1 and 3 and verse 7, the likewise, or as the NIV translates it, in the same way, that's what likewise means, in the same manner or in the same way. So this actually points back to verse 13. It is because we're Christians that we are to submit to human governments. You look at verse 13, it's about submitting to the ordinance of man, whether king is supreme or other governors or so forth. So God has established human government for there to be some kind of order on the earth, some kind of order in society. And he said, because you're a Christian, you are to submit yourself to those laws of the land. Again, as long as they don't contradict God. Again, that's for the better good. Because it's good for there to be a peaceful type of society, then we submit. That's the reason the wife is to submit to her husband in the day-to-day decisions. Again, non-salvation issues. We understand that's the exception. And areas that don't affect our relationship with God, because remember, verse 7 says you're on heirs together, you're on the same playing ground in terms of your salvation. We'll see that again in a few minutes in Ephesians 5. We will go to Ephesians 5 as well. But getting back to verse 7, it says, in the same way, in like manner, likewise, husbands, just like Jesus Christ put his needs below, or his desires below the needs of others, so you as husbands dwell with your wife with understanding, giving her honor, showing her honor. We need to understand those needs. We need to understand the needs of our wife. We need to view them as important. Doing so honors our wife. Now, understanding these differences and living with your mate, rightly applying this knowledge, can greatly affect your satisfaction level in marriage. It can have a big impact on that. And that's what I said I would like to focus on, ultimately, is dealing with this major key to satisfaction in marriage. I hope we see this passage has a lot more to offer than just two words. Honor and submit, or submit and dwell with knowledge. Yes, wives are to submit, and husbands are to honor them as a weaker partner. But if a husband uses that verse 1 to beat his head over the wife, beat his wife over the head with the word submit, he's missed the whole point of it, hasn't he? Because likewise, he's supposed to do something, just like Jesus Christ. He's supposed to do something. He's supposed to treat her in a different way. Let's take a look at this perspective, how it dovetails, as I said, with Paul's instruction in Ephesians chapter 5. Let's go to Ephesians 5. And again, when we turn there, many of us who've been around for a while think of the submit verse, don't we? If we're familiar with the passage. But starting there again misses the point. Because there is context to the chapter. There's context to each of the statements that Paul makes about wives and about husbands. What's the point? What's the point, or what's the context? Well, again, if we look at the immediate context of Ephesians chapter 5, where it talks about wives submitting, Ephesians chapter 5, verse 22, talks about wives. But if we look at the immediate context, we see that there's more to it. We just focus on the context or the idea of putting others above ourselves. And that's very important. We see verse 21 says, submitting to one another in the fear of God. Now, some people want to divorce this, separate this, draw a line in their Bibles between verse 21 and verse 22 and say, well, verse 21 applies to the church as a whole, that we as Christians ought to submit ourselves to one another. But verse 22 is where it starts getting into the personal family life. And my contention is, how can you separate the two? I mean, what is the greatest relationship we're supposed to have? The most intimate relationship, hopefully the longest lasting relationship in our life. We hope that's our marriage relationship. That would be where we hope it would be. It means a lot to think about this from the bigger perspective. It's important for us to think about in marriage, to submit to one another, to think about our mate and put their needs above our desires. And of course, sometimes that gets harder to do as time goes by. 15, 20, 30, 40 years. Sometimes it gets to be difficult. What if one's trying and the other isn't? Well, there's going to be a lot of dissatisfaction in the marriage, isn't there? If one is doing their part and the other is not doing their part. And if the dissatisfaction gets bad enough, if it's egregious enough, or gets to the level that it's really showing the fruits of an unbelieving mate, it's no wonder that the offended one wants to end the relationship. And that's a sad thing to see happen. I'll add my pastoral caution that such a decision should not be made lightly. You should pray about it a lot and should counsel about that. There are circumstances where God's word says that is acceptable. But don't do it lightly. Where do we start if we don't start in verse 22? To get the context of this, after all, many Bibles have a convenient heading there. Maybe yours does. I've got several Bibles that have a nice little heading there that says wives and husbands. So don't talk about wives and husbands. Just ignore everything before that. You just start right here in verse 22. Well, again, that's ignoring the context. Where do we start? Well, verse 21, I said, this is an important one. Submitting to one another is in the fear of God. We husbands have problems with that sometimes, because in our minds we think, wait a minute, if I'm supposed to lead, you're telling me I'm supposed to submit? How do I lead if I'm supposed to submit? God's giving me conflicting instructions, or you're trying to tell me conflicting instructions. Leading means I simply lead. I'm the head. Well, I would ask another question. How much of the natural, human, Gentile approach to leadership do we still harbor? Jesus Christ had a lot to say to the disciples about the type of leadership that he wanted to see among his people. And it was not the way the Gentiles did things, to lord it over them and say, I'm the boss, you do what I say regardless. When I say jump, you ask how high. That's all you need to ask. That's not the approach that Christ wants in the church. It's not the approach we should take in the marriage relationship either, I don't believe. I'd like to quote Zondervan's Study Bible comment on this verse, verse 21. He says, this is basic to the following paragraphs, meaning the ones that talk about husbands and wives. Paul will show how in each relationship, each partner can have a conciliatory attitude that will help that relationship. The grammar indicates that this mutual submission is associated with the filling of the Spirit in verse 18. The command, be filled, in verse 18 is followed by a series of participles in the Greek. Speaking, verse 19. Singing, verse 19. Making music, verse 19. Giving thanks, in 20. And submitting, in verse 21. So let's go back to verse 18. Let's look at verse 18. He says, and do not be drunk with wine, in which is dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit. What does the Spirit give us? I mean, we're in those days leading up to the Feast of Pentecost. What is it that the Spirit, the Holy Spirit of God, what is it that that is supposed to develop in us? Well, the simple answer is more of the mind of Christ, isn't it? To be of the same attitude, the same mind as God the Father and Jesus Christ. We're supposed to become more like them. So being filled with the Spirit means that we are becoming more like God, that we are following His lead. Speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord, giving thanks always for all things to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, submitting to one another in the fear of God. Again, submit to one another because of the better good. We saw this in Peter's instructions to wives and husbands, and we see it leading up to Paul's teaching about husbands and wives also, that we need to keep this idea of mutual submission in mind, the idea of putting the needs of another ahead of our own, as Peter taught. And as Christ did, He set the example in doing that. He is our example. Now, I'm not going to read through all of this. I'd like to jump down to the very end of this chapter. Let's look at Paul's summary statement. Again, this don't have the time, don't want to take the time today to go through this whole passage. But he makes a statement in verse 32 about this being about Christ in the church. But there's an analogy, and literally, he says, it also applies in your marriage, in the marriage relationship. Verse 33, nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. You know, if I were reading this as a reading assignment, I would say, okay, he just gave me the takeaways, you know. These are two things he really wants me to take away from this. Nevertheless, here's what I'm saying. Let a man love his wife as himself, and the wife see that she respects her husband. Shows him that respect. Husbands, we're supposed to love our wives as ourselves. And wives, respect your husbands. It's not wives, obey your husbands. It's wise, respect your husbands. There's a difference. It's not husbands, you have carte blanche to do anything you wish, and the wife's supposed to just let you trample on her. Whatever you wish. That's not what God says either. I think we understand that. I'm belaboring it to make the point. That would do great violence to the intent and the meaning of this passage. I've long felt these two words, love and respect, are very important in marriage. Very important to the marriage relationship. How well do we as husbands express the love for our wife? And how well do wives express that respect for their husbands? See, that's where some of the psychological difference comes in between men and women. Women need not just to know their love, they need to feel loved. Okay, God gave most women more of the feeling side of things than men, okay? Just the way it is. Not everyone, but in general. And they need to feel that they are loved. The message has to be communicated on all levels so it penetrates right down to the deepest parts of their heart. They know they're loved, and they feel that love. In general, that's one of the needs. Now, if you're talking, but it's not a language your spouse understands, you're not really communicating, are you? If you're speaking Yiddish and you tell your wife over and over, I love you, but she only understands Spanish or German or some other language, you're not really communicating, are you? There's been a lot written about love languages, five love languages, and I don't want to get into the details of that today, but it is important to know how to communicate to your spouse. Husband or wife, how to communicate so that you make sure you do have clear communications. Wives need to know that no matter what else happens, they are loved, cherished, honored by their husbands, that he deeply adores her, wishes the very best for her in all aspects of life. And while men want to be loved, there seems to be a side of the male psyche that really has greater need for respect. That he knows his wife loves him, but he also knows she respects him. That she has a certain amount of respect for who he is, of what he is, and what he does. For what he provides for his wife and for his family. They need that affirmation of their value. Again, varies by person. Some need it more than others. But in general, Paul, God, through Paul, is telling us these are two of the major areas that are needed in marriage. Husbands need to know they're respected. Wives need to know they're loved. Now, of course, there can be many other factors that greatly impact a marriage. Misuse of finances, opposite views of finances, disagreements over finances, communication issues, addictions, infidelity. I mean, there are all kinds of things that also impact this relationship. I'm just talking about the normal kind of standard relationship, barring any other big issues, that these two have struck me for a long time as being very, very important. Again, I'm not trying to suggest that if you've had trouble or gone through a divorce, that you can look at this and say, well, if I had only done this, you know, that would have solved everything. I'm not saying that. It's not a panacea. But in most cases, it is very important that a husband feels respected and the wife feels loved. For a second time, I won't go further into this, but I heard a short radio interview with an author that focuses on these two points in marriage. I mean, he's made his career in marriage counseling on these two, and he's written a book, Love and Respect. Subtitle is The Love She Most Desires, The Respect He Desperately Needs. I purchased the book, look forward to reading it. I hope that as a wise person, I like to think of myself as wise, that I may get wiser by reading the book. Maybe some other insights I can get into this particular topic, but I think it is an important one. We started in the book of Proverbs, and before we close, I would like to go back to the book of Proverbs. We started in chapter 30 with the words of Agur, about the mysteries of how the specifics of two people getting together come to love one another, come to begin that marriage relationship with the hopes that it's going to be a lifelong relationship, that it's going to be a good relationship, a satisfying relationship. We all go into marriage with those ideas and those hopes and those desires. I'd like to share a few thoughts about what we find in the last chapter, Proverbs chapter 31. Now, this week, this particular chapter was of interest to a number of people with, again, our National Mother's Day holiday. Many ladies have read this particular passage over the years and wondered how they could ever live up to this high standard of the perfect wife that seems to be described in Proverbs chapter 31. I find it interesting to look at this description beginning in verse 10. Who can find a virtuous wife, as my New King James says, her worth is far above rubies. And then he begins to list a number of things. Now, you may describe it differently, but I came up with my own checklist. Here's what I see in Proverbs 31 of what is described here as this wife of great value. Actually, wife of valor might be a little more appropriate. We'll come back to that. But here's my checklist. She's wealthy. Right? I mean, very early on it says her husband lacks no gain. He's a kept man, right? Wouldn't we all love to be kept men? No. But she's wealthy. All right, lets a lot of us off the hook right there, doesn't it, ladies? No, but she is. She's wealthy. She works with wool and flax with her own hands. She shops all over to pick the best food for her household. She gets up before dawn to feed her family and her servants, so she has servants. She's astute at real estate. She always makes a profit. Talks about her gains, never talks about her losses. She knows the details of planting and tending vineyards. She's physically strong, healthy, and tireless. Everything she makes is of good value. She stays up all night working. Lamp doesn't go out, and yet she's up before dawn. This lady never sleeps, does she? She spins her own thread. She weaves her own cloth. She cares for the poor and the needy. She's an exceptional seamstress. Her husband is a leading citizen. Sits in the gates. Everything she says is full of wisdom. She never utters a cross word, just kindness. She has perfect children and a perfect husband who have nothing but praise for her every action. Right? Okay, where is she? I've got her, right? No. I mean, you look at this, it's wow. This is incredible to look at this list. Nothing but praise. How can anyone ever measure up to that description? And you know what? Maybe that's exactly the point. That nobody is intended to live up to this exact list of things. Maybe nobody's supposed to. Let's go back to verse 10, where it says, who can find a virtuous wife? Now look at my margin, and my margin says, verses 10 through 31 are an alphabetic acrostic in the Hebrew. It means it's a poem. It starts out with the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and the next verse starts with the next letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and the next verse starts with the next. It is written as poetry. That's the first point to recognize about this. It's a poem. It is not dialogue in the sense of a chronological list of things. It's a poem. Now, my margin also says, literally, in terms of virtuous woman, literally, wife of valor. She is a wife of valor in the sense of all forms of excellence. In fact, if you look that Hebrew word up, Brown, Driver, Biggs, and other lexicons will tell you that word literally means strength. It means might. And it's a military word. Because, I mean, this is a word for those who are mighty in valor, those who win battles, those who are successful generals. This is a word that is used to describe them. This is a woman of valor that is described. It might interest you also to realize that Ruth is called a woman of noble character. Some translations translate it that way, noble character. Remember the story of Ruth in Ruth chapter 3, verse 11. I'll give you the reference. You can look it up later. But Boaz calls Ruth a woman of noble character. Now, she's a noble a woman of valor, a woman of noble character, and the description is very similar to what we find about Boaz himself. I'll give you that reference as well, not turn to it. Ruth chapter 2 and verse 1 talks about him as having standing in the gate. Literally, the word is strength. Literally, it means valor. He's a man of valor. She is a woman of valor. That was said by Boaz when Ruth was doing what? Was she spinning, making her own thread, making her own cloth? Was she buying and selling property? Was she planting vineyards? No, she was gleaning fields, wasn't she? It was while she was gleaning fields that she was called a woman of valor or high character. And again, the description is very, very similar to what is said of Boaz. So this woman of valor in Proverbs 31, as I'll call her, is presented as a wealthy aristocrat. She's got servants. She's got all this, she's got money. I mean, she can go buy property. She has the ability to do lots of things. Expositor's Bible Commentary says she appears as a personification of wisdom in this passage. And if you think about that, that she is personifying wisdom, just like a woman was personified in the Bible and earlier in the book of Proverbs, adultery is personified as a woman. That's the woman to avoid. This is the woman to follow. This is the right type of woman. The acrostic form of the poem, they say, gives the appearance of laying out the ABCs of what wisdom looks like in everyday life. These are the kinds of things that somebody, a woman of wisdom, will work to build into her life. These kinds of things in everyday life. Not that it's a checklist for everybody to have to do everything at all points in their life. The Zondervan Study Bible, NIV Study Bible, points out the purpose of the whole book. Again, it's laid out in the first seven verses of chapter 1. Again, to give prudence to the simple, knowledge and discretion to the young, to make wise men wiser, and to focus on wisdom. Hold your place here. I do want to turn to chapter 1 and look at verse 7, because we see in Proverbs 1 and verse 7, it says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction." Fools despise it. But fearing God is the beginning point of that. It's the start of it. And chapters 1 through 9 then of Proverbs contrast the way of wisdom with the path of violence and immorality. So if we look at this from, again, a bigger perspective, it's the right fear, the reverence, the loving, along with submission and obedience to God, that's the foundation for wisdom. And here at the end of the book, in chapter 31, if we go back to chapter 31, it's this woman of valor fearing God. If you look at the end of the chapter, verse 30, "Charm is deceitful and beauty is passing, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised." The woman of valor who fears God. The verse closes with what chapter 1 begins talking about. Wisdom. Wisdom. In that sense, it's the other bookend to the whole book of Proverbs, describing what's important in God's perspective. It leads one to think that this ending about a woman of virtue or valor is symbolic, coming right back to the point of the beginning of the book, that we need to apply wisdom in everyday life. Let me share one paragraph with you. I'd like to read from Expositors. It says, "This poem certainly presents a pattern for women who want to develop a life of wisdom, but since it is essentially about wisdom, its lessons are for both men and women to develop." Oh, man, we're back to the same again, aren't we? You mean I got to develop women just like this woman of valor that I've married to and want to marry? We're the same again, aren't we? "Lessons for both men and women to develop. This passage teaches that the fear of the Lord will inspire people to be faithful stewards of the time and talents that God has given. That wisdom is productive and beneficial for others, requiring great industry in life's endeavors, that wisdom is best taught and lived in the home. Indeed, the success of the home demands wisdom, and that wisdom is balanced living, giving attention to domestic responsibilities as well as to business enterprises and to charitable service. And when you get all the balance in that, come tell me. So all the rest of us can learn from you, because it's a challenge for all of us, isn't it, to keep the right balance in all of this. But yet, this is what they're saying. This is wisdom, is to apply this in our everyday life. I thought that was an interesting way of looking at this. So we're back to this idea of being much the same, men and women, aren't we? It's certainly true in many areas, our ultimate goal of being in God's family, and the way He looks at us in terms of our potential. However, as we've seen today, God also recognizes there are some nuances. There are some nuances, differences in the way He made us as male and female. There are different things that are important. And if we want, again, the most satisfaction in life, particularly in marriage, that most important long-lasting, hopefully lifetime long-lasting relationship, we need some knowledge of our mate. We need to understand at least enough to meet the needs of our mate. We need to apply that knowledge. We need to know how to convey what they need to them so that they get the message. We need to help. We need to seek to fill their needs. My experience, again, in dealing with marriages is that in the normal scheme of married life, how well we do at communicating these issues are very important. How well a wife does or a husband does in communicating faithful love to his wife and expressing that honor and respect is going to go a long way to making the marriage satisfied. And I've also noticed that quite often the more a husband does that, the more a wife respects him and vice versa. And when it doesn't happen on one side, it often doesn't happen on the other. Because it's difficult, very difficult, when you don't receive what you need in the relationship. It's very difficult to give what the other needs. And how do you get out of that rut, that cycle? That's a difficult thing that takes two people agreeing that we're going to work together to make this the best possible relationship that we can. So if you're married, I'd encourage you to meditate on this instruction from God through Peter and Paul, to think about how it can help you grow, how it can help you build a satisfaction in your marriage. If you're single, if you're single but looking for a mate, again, I take note of the wisdom of Proverbs. Seek a wife of valor. Seek a husband of valor. Seek one who puts God in the right place first in their life. Someone of noble character, as some translations have it. And then apply it in your own life. Apply these principles. No matter what our marital status, realize these words from God are important because they will be helpful to us when we deal with people in the world tomorrow. In the millennium, in the white throne judgment, we all are going to have individuals to deal with and try to help. And this wonderful blessing that God gave us of marriage that sometimes becomes a stressful situation. But God desires it to be good. So think about these. I hope we can apply these words to improve our satisfaction in marriage.